from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. First, it was Facebook. Users plugged in to see what their friends were up to, then tracked and shared what they read or listened to on, say, Spotify. Now, some are looking inward, tracking themselves via wireless apps, collecting millions of bytes of data on their moods, diets, stress levels, sleep patterns, sex lives, and then using the data to change their behavior or share for their health care. This hour on Point, the digital self, the quantified self, and where it's taking us. You can join the conversation. Are you plugged in, wirelessed up, collecting reams of data on everything you can measure about yourself? With what goal? You can let us know at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio, your latest vitals and what you make of them. Joining us first today is Gary Wolf, writer at Wired Magazine, co-founder of the Quantified Self Movement, grew out of a blog that started in 08 titled The Quantified Self, now has followers all over the country. It's a forum for users to discuss their new technologies to track themselves. He also organizes annual Quantified Self conferences. Gary Wolf, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What is this Quantified Self Movement? You're deep into it, but some of us haven't gone there. Tell us about it, Gary.
Well, simply put, it's a collaboration among users and makers of tools for self-tracking. And we ask, what are they good for? What can we learn from them? And how can we get some of the answers that we're seeking?
So people are wearing apps or have apps in their smartphone or in a wristband or a headband doing what?
Well, there's a huge number of tools, and some of the ones that are the easiest to understand and are the most popular and widespread are things like digital pedometers. So many people track how many steps they take. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's not noticed that that is taking a physical activity and turning it into a data stream. So every day you have a number, and that number is something that you can learn things from. Now, pedometers aren't necessarily digital. Pedometers have been around for a long time. But the fact that we have really small sensors, like little accelerometers, and also really cheap chips that will collect the data and wirelessly transmit it to a computer, for instance, to your phone, which is a powerful computer you carry with you all the time, mm-hmm. allows you to do new things with the data. For instance, correlate it with other kinds of data that you're collecting. And suddenly you have access to the tools of science for your personal use.
Putting together a complete profile off of all this data. I mean, I'm reading here, Gary, about apps that will track your heart rate, you know, beats per minute, I guess, or blood pressure, or will be on your nightstand while you sleep or on your wrist, I'm not sure, and tracking the quality and particular nature of your sleep. Give us a sense of the full range here, of what's being tracked. Give us the range.
Sure. And I like to start with a pedometer because everybody understands it, but you quickly see all kinds of tracking that looks very avant-garde if you haven't seen it before. We have EEG, which is the electrical signal off your scalp that tells you what's coming from your brain. You have EMG, electromyography, which is the electrical signals that your muscles send, telling when your muscles activate. You have EKG from your heart, and now we're starting to get heart rate on the wrist, and also some additional measures that are derived from heart rate, like heart rate variability, the time between your heartbeats, which mm-hmm. tells you a lot about your stress. Mm-hmm. You have GSR, which is galvanic skin response, which is the electrical signal that moves across your skin like in an old-fashioned lie detector. And people are using that to find out information about stress and arousal and excitation. Mm-hmm. You have voice tracking. So people can you can tell things about your state through measuring things in your voice, the pace, the volume. You have tools that you wear on your forehead that will tell you how well you sleep with a degree of accuracy that used to be available only if you went into a sleep lab and slept in a laboratory. So things are going very, very broad as well as very, very deep.
There's a long list and really just the beginning of things that come off of sensors that people will wear or have near them. I've got a little tape here. This involves one product called Zio. It's a sleep manager, and it's got a sleep fairy that here it's talking to David Pogue, of the New York Times. You'll hear him at the end. I guess he wore this thing, and now the Sleep Fairy, his wireless app, is reporting back to him on the quality of his sleep. Here's the Sleep Fairy from Zio.
And then when you actually did fall asleep, you woke up 2 times in the middle of the night. And then when you were actually sleeping, that you spent almost 3 hours in REM sleep, which is one of the best types of sleep. It's called rapid eye movement sleep, and it's when your brain finally gets to rest. And you spent about 6 hours in light sleep, which is actually kind of useless. And then 50 minutes or close to an hour in deep sleep, which is actually where your muscles get restored.
Wow, that's cool and also a little creepy.
Okay, there. I guess a demo of a Zio Sleep Manager. Cool and a little creepy. And I'm not sure that's how it would normally report back, but there's a kind of a demo version of it, looking at sleep.
I think he was making that part up. I used my Zio last night, and I have to say, David got really good sleep in that demo, and mine wasn't nearly as good as his.
Give us an example with Zio. What does it really track about your sleep, and what can it tell you?
Well, it's measuring the electrical signals coming from your brain, and it's doing that with a little sensor that's just right on your scalp. I mean, it just sits on your skin, so mm-hmm. It's a not very invasive sensor. It does have a strap that goes around your head, and so that's something that makes you look like the geek that you are when you wear it.
Embrace the geek. Yes,
but it's not uncomfortable in any way. And what it tells you, it can pick up an electrical signal that tells you when you're asleep and when you're awake, first, and second, what phases of sleep you're in. And then it makes a record of that you can use, you can export, you can correlate with other things. So, for instance, as you heard in the mm-hmm. tape that David made, REM sleep and deep sleep are the components of sleep that people that care about the most. They seem to have the most effect on our well-being, our recovery from exercise or training, our memory and cognition. And so by keeping track of those, you can start to see if things you're doing in your life improve or degrade your sleep.
And, of course, that's kind of the basis for what goes on during much of the day. And does it then give you advice on how to change that, or when to wake up, or when to go to bed differently, or something different to do?
Well, that's a great question. There is a lot of advice out there about how to improve your sleep. So it's easy to get advice. And that's true about any area where we want to improve ourselves. There's a lot of advice mongering going on. And the question that we have, I mm-hmm. think, for ourselves is, does the advice work? And if you ask whether some piece of advice works, whether you get that from a doctor or from a trainer or from a friend or from anybody, sometimes you might say, well, I don't think that advice works. And the answer is often, well, you didn't do it right, or, you know, you're not doing it enough, or, mm-hmm. you know, the small bottle didn't work, buy the big bottle. And, mm-hmm. and you're left not really knowing whether the things you're trying are effective or not. And the nice thing about having tools of self-measurement that are reliable and accurate is that you can then discover for yourself whether the advice that's available to you actually works for you, and possibly even discover some new things that nobody would think of recommending because they haven't been discovered.
But if you try them and they give you the numbers, they give you the feedback off all this monitoring and it's working, well, then it's working. This is possible because your life, biological life we've been talking about here, is quantified through all these sensor-based monitoring apps. Now, the quantified life also has some faces that are not sensor-based, right? But sort of reporting in, I guess, Gary.
Yes, and, you know, the new sensors are part of the story. But an equally important part is our ability to gather the data conveniently and store it and look at it. And that's simply the next stage in personal computing. Computers have become very personal. They're small. They're easy to use. We carry them with us all the time. So that means even if you have an app that you simply press a little button, you know, on the screen to say, yes, I did this, or no, I didn't do mm-hmm. this, that becomes part of a database that you can use. And that's a lot easier than making a mark in a notebook and then going back and tallying all the numbers. These tools make it so easy to work with the data that suddenly you can get insights that weren't available before.
It can know what kind of exercise you're getting from sensors and more. You can snap a photo of the food on your plate, and you've got apps that will put together kind of a diet analysis, a caloric analysis. But what about when it comes to mood, relationships, even sex life? I assume that's some kind of self-reporting going on.
Sure, and it's really interesting. Say mood, a lot of people in the quantified self movement are interested in mood, tracking their mood, and learning from their mood. Well, there's a sort of glitch in tracking your mood if you do it just by making a mark in a notebook, say, and that is you may only note what your mood is when you're in the mood to make a note.
Right.
And that's confounding. You really don't get a good observation from doing that. So one of the things people are trying is they have an app that will just ping you randomly with a very simple question, either via text message or, you know, any of the other ways that our computers can talk to us, and just ask you to rate your mood at that moment. And by working with those random queries, you now are using a tool of social science to look into yourself and getting rid of one of the confounding factors.
And if you put all this together with your EEGs and EMGs and EKGs and, you know, sleep monitors and the rest, you may find, and diet and exercise, you may find relationships between your inputs and your exercise, the way you're living, and mood or many other things. Gary, collectively, what does all this make possible?
There are really big, very active dreams, you might even call them fantasies, in the world of public health and management about what could be done if we had all the data about everything that everybody does. Those dreams may come to fruition or they may look sort of ugly. But in the meantime, we can learn simple things about ourselves.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the move to the digital self, the quantified self, that is, humans monitored every minute very often by wireless apps tracking activity, health, moods, lives. Gary Wolf is with us from Berkeley, California, co-founder of the Quantified Self Movement, writer for Wired magazine. You can link to his blog at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can see a lot of apps in this category there as well that may be interesting to you if you're not already all wired up to them. Here's a little sound from one, MoodScope. It's an online service that helps you measure and respond to moods. Here's a promotional video bit. It explains how MoodScope tracks your data and uses it, it says, to help you.
You can accurately measure your mood every day with an online card game based on one of psychology's most proven mood tests. Your daily scores get tracked on a graph to which you can add comments so you can learn what causes your ups and downs. The final piece of the jigsaw is nominating trusted friends who receive your scores by email from the site. They support you by acting as your buddies.
And you've got your daily score on your mood. Gary, we've got a lot of callers here already. Let's turn to a few. Then we're going to hear of some of the medical applications people are anticipating here. But first, Richmond, Kentucky. Lauren, thanks for calling. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My roommate actually uses a lot of these apps. He uses the Fitbit, the S2H monitor, the Nike Plus in his shoe. And some of the things that I had just wanted to mention that were good for us was he discovered using the Fitbit sleep monitor that he was sleeping really badly in his room and not badly in the living room. So we went in the room and we checked, and it turned out there was a buzzing sound that we hadn't noticed.
Right.
And that was disturbing his sleep, and we fixed it, and he was able to sleep in his room.
So he's using a bunch of these. So you've got three or four that he's using. What do you think of it, Lauren? Does it make sense to you? Or it looks like
I think it makes perfect sense. I love it. Of course, I'm also a science fiction lit major, so I can see all of the little connections to things that I've read in the dystopic novels. But I don't think that anyone's going to force us to use them. They'll be all right.
Hey, Lauren, good luck to you and your roommate there with tracking and tracking away. I mean, Gary, it's interesting. We've got such a range of response to this online. You've got people who love it. Here's Ashwin says, oh, yes, you know, I have an app for my weight. I have an app to record my gas mileage. I have another one to track my sleep patterns. You know, I look at the trends and extrapolate. So using the numbers, the measurement to pay attention. But then we've got others here. Jeff Hefe writes, the height of narcissism with apps. And you can post it all 24/7 on Facebook. And here Naturalist writes, are people so out of touch with their bodies and themselves that they need apps? Incredible. Another distraction to remove us from ourselves. I guess there's always going to be a range of response here to new ways, Gary.
I love hearing that range. And I think all of those reactions tell us something. Lauren's story is a typical kind of story that we hear at Quantified Self, and in a way, it's why the group exists, because that's interesting to find out that somebody used one of these tools and learned something useful, and that simple tale of how it was used and what it produced might inspire somebody to learn something else. We saw a talk at one of our meetings from a guy who had been an Olympic medalist in velodrome cycling and had gotten out of shape and started training again, and was having trouble recovering from training, and eventually discovered through just, he showed the graph, really simple data, but unavailable if he hadn't been monitoring himself, that as the summer months went on and his room heated up, his deep sleep degraded. And as his deep sleep degraded, his training recovery degraded. And so all he had to do was reduce the temperature of where of when he was sleeping, and his deep sleep went up, and he now is a world record holder. So that's the kind of thing that he couldn't have discovered in a book, really. This is learning. And some people see using these tools as removing ourselves from the intuitive sense of who we are. And I think that they can do that. But I would just add to that, that these tools also can become an extension of our senses so that we're capable of noticing things about ourselves that we otherwise would have missed. And in that sense, they bring us closer to ourselves.
This is really interesting. You've got, I guess, a supporter of this online. AC writes to us about skeptics. He says, I'm sure the first caveman to try and control fire for the benefit of his little cave town had to listen to all the elders shaking their heads, swearing that they were going to burn, he was going to burn down the village. On the other hand, and you must have seen this kind of critique, here's Mike Elgin. He was writing in Computer World and paying attention to the people who are really into the quantified self movement. And he says that this movement, he's writing here, appears to be driven by an unusual impulse to remake oneself into a cyborg or robot to conquer one's own biology and overcome its mysteries and limitations the way one masters a PC or a network. Elgin says it's an appealing concept to people inclined to view the body as a meat robot. Yikes.
Well, I think that we do see, I do see sometimes people express a fantasy that they could optimize themselves, like get into a perfect state through having enough data. Of course, that's hard. It's even conceptually perhaps contradictory because you can only optimize something against a known target, right? You're sort of getting closer to this perfection that you want to reach. But humans don't really have targets. Humans, the goal of being alive is not something that's known. That's something that we discover through living. So I don't know that really optimizing ourselves or becoming perfect is really what's driving this in. What's driving it is people have specific problems that they're trying to solve or areas about themselves that they in which they have curiosity. And I think pursuing curiosity and trying to solve problems is a great human activity, and you know we're all going to keep doing it with whatever tools we have available.
Well, you say humans don't have known targets, and in some great metaphysical sense maybe that's true. But then, you know, you've got outfits out there like, I think, you know, 100 Plus is this new startup. And I think what they're looking to do is compiling tons of CDC data, medical record data on all kinds of health, so that you can then, in part, compare your daily measurements to the optimal, at least as found by the CDC.
Well, here you have just a stage in an ongoing process. People do have goals. I'm not saying they don't have goals, and we all have goals. It's just that when you hear, I think it was Mike Elgin saying that people want to turn themselves into perfect robots or something like this, it's sort of an error to think that we have some optimal human model that we're trying to imitate, because that model doesn't exist.
But nobody, once we're quantified, really you know, human beings, we will be judging our own what heart rate and everything else against, I don't know, the Olympic level heart rates or the median or mean of the country or the world. I
okay.
mean, right?
That's really a good point, because when we try to ask ourselves, are we doing as well as we want to do, what is our reference point? And the reference points, say the mean or the median or, you know, the within the proper boundaries that you might see on a lab report that you get back from your doctor, these are produced by population-level studies that kind of mush everybody together and right. say, here's a kind of, if you squint your eyes, kind of the good way to be. But of course, that may not be applicable to us. And one of the things that happens in the quantified self is people begin to compare themselves into who they already are. In a sense, it's improvement to in relation to your current state, not improvement in relation to an imaginary typical or imaginary optimal human being. And that's much more realistic, especially in areas that people care about a lot, for instance, weight and diet. You can get all the information you want to get about what your ideal weight is in relation to the population. But really what you should be looking at is what your weight goals are in relation to how you are today and how you might reasonably improve.
Look, I mean, it's not hard to imagine great payoffs from this. If you've got something going on with your body that otherwise you wouldn't discover until an annual or, you know, many people less than annual physical, and instead you find it within days of it appearing off of some monitor, that sounds like it could be pretty good, but people look at this all kinds of ways. Corb writes to us, life is a computer game where one needs to score. I don't know. Uli in Ludlow, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Uli. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a comment to make. I find this technology pretty interesting, like an interesting possibility that might well help to make medical costs a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I have my husband had an unusual case where he would often wake up with headaches. He occasionally would pass out in the morning. We would have a lot of tests done on him, and nobody ever really figured out what was wrong.
Okay.
And I think these technologies may have at least given us some more ideas. I don't know if, it may just have It may not have changed the outcome. He ultimately passed away. But,
I'm sorry, Uli. But
who knows, it might have just worried him more, but that something was up. But
Uli, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that with your husband. But I can feel, we can hear you imagining that maybe if there had been more more dense monitoring, you might have learned something more here.
Right, for sure. Yeah.
Wow. Uli, I'm sorry for your husband, but I appreciate your call. There's a vote for more and a thought about what consequences it might have had. One more right here. Jim in Nashville. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Seems one real practical application is for people with diabetes. You can monitor your blood sugar. You can download your data into your laptop. You can follow it and track it. You can modify your diet and activities accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you can use on an everyday basis, and you don't have to have a lot of technical skill or, as you mentioned earlier, go out on the internet and try to find a lot of technical data and sort out how to use it. I mean, it's a real practical everyday solution that impacts tens of millions of people every day.
And, of course, Jim, lots of diabetics have been doing that for a long time, but if you've got a wireless network here, you can automatically be reporting in to medical professionals, I guess.
Can I pick up on the diabetic comment? This is a really interesting area, and it hasn't come up yet in our conversation, because monitoring glucose levels in the blood, monitoring metabolism is something, Tom, as you say, that diabetics have been doing for a long time. Type 1 diabetics, people whose diabetes is produced by an inherited condition usually, who have often diabetics since childhood or teenage years, are experts at this. There are a lot of diabetics now and an increasing number of them that are type 2 diabetics. The diabetes is a slower onset, environmentally conditioned type of diabetes. And that shades into the general population who may have all kinds of questions or issues relating to metabolism. And I think glucose monitoring, which is now a medical practice, is going to become generally used, widespread self-tracking practice that will really catch people by surprise. Are you kidding me? You mean everybody or many, many people are tracking their blood glucose? How could that be? That's so bizarre. And yet I think that's where we're headed.
Gary, I want to welcome into our conversation from Dana Point, California, Eric Topol. He's author of the new book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create better health care. He's a cardiologist and geneticist at Scripps Health and Scripps Research Institute in San Diego. Eric Topol, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
You've got a very big vision of what this kind of wireless app monitoring of human health may bring about. What do you see, Eric? What's possible?
Well, what you've been talking about with Gary and the callers is about really people who are generally healthy and want to learn more about themselves. But now this can be applied very broadly in medicine. Medicine up till now has been population-based, not knowing about the data from each individual. But, for example, you know, we have 70 million people with high blood pressure in this country, and we know that at least half of them have poor control, but we've never had a window into blood pressure during the night or during stress. And now we will, you know, through a smartphone. The same as just mentioned via glucose monitoring, minute to minute, through a smartphone. We've never had these tools before, and it's a rebooting of the future of medicine, and it's really quite exciting.
So you're talking about putting together all kinds of monitoring and measurement here and what, feeding it wirelessly to medical professionals who can sort of keep track of how an individual is doing over time?
Well, you touched on a really key point there, because now we're talking about the real democratization of medicine, whereby the consumer, the patient, it's their data. It's on their smartphone, and it's all, you know, processed and graphed, and of course it's archived. And then it's their decision whether to get input and guidance. It doesn't have to automatically be sent to the doctor, but that, of course, could be very helpful. The other thing, of course, is that it could spur managed competition among one's social network for the best blood pressure, the best glucose, the best, you know, whatever the measurement is relevant to that individual. So there's all sorts of things you can do once you have this data available on an individual basis.
But when I sort of dip into your vision, Eric, what comes to mind is a picture where you've got millions and millions of people being monitored a lot, and when their vital signs go off in some funny direction, I don't know, a flag going up in their doctor's office, and he can look right in great detail, all the way down to the genome, as you describe it, on what's going on with them. And maybe instead of them calling in and saying, I don't feel good, he calls them and says, or she, you're not going to feel good unless we do something here. I see some trends showing up via all your sensors.
Absolutely. No, you're bringing up the other side of this, which is being able to be preventive or preemptive. And there's no question that having data that we never had before is affording that opportunity, really an extraordinary one.
Tom, if I can jump in for
a
second. That scenario you described is really appealing in some senses, but that's not today's doctor. So even today, what we see in the quantified self is people who are doing these practices, some very simple, measuring their blood pressure, for instance, walk into their doctor's office. They say to their doctor, look, you know, I know I'm high on blood pressure. I know you recommended that I go on a couple medications, but I've been tracking it, and I want to show you my graph because the conversation stops right there. The doctor's like, okay, let's get you up on the table, and we'll take your blood pressure. And you say, hey, wait. I've got twice-a-day blood pressure measures for 3 months. The doctor's like, well, yes, I know you have that data, but let's get you up here and let's measure blood pressure.
So it's not all put together at this point, but Eric Topol's laying out a vision of when it could be. Says that it could be great for human health, and not just that, but for the cost of health care. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the move to the digital self, the quantified self. That is, humans monitored more or less every minute or second by wireless apps, tracking our activity, our health, our moods, our lives, and where that may take us, our understanding of ourselves, our health care, potentially a lot more. Gary Wolf is with us, writer for Wired Magazine, co-founder of the Quantified Self Movement. He's deep into it. Eric Topol is with us from Dana Point, California. He's a cardiologist and geneticist, author of The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create Better Healthcare, joins us from California. We've got all kinds of response online. I'm going to dip into some of it. Let's go first to Tina in Monroe, New Hampshire. Tina, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm glad to be able to share my views on this issue with you.
Great.
I'm currently in a program to be certified as a health coach, and I think that ties right in with where these digital apps and all this health awareness is leading. Our country's in big trouble with people's personal health issues,
right.
Diabetes, heart disease, smoking, obesity. And the previous caller mentioned that you may be sitting in a doctor's office describing symptoms or issues and problems you may be concerned with, and they'll cut you off and put you on a medication, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the health coach is going to come in. Some insurance companies at this point are even paying for these services. People, as they become aware of their health issues and realize that they need to make changes in their lifestyles, it can only help to have support from either a group or an individual health coach or nutrition coach to help you along on a weekly or maybe bi-weekly basis in supporting you, offering you some options that are available to you. And these digital apps and monitoring devices that people are using are causing people to become a lot more aware of what they may need to do in their lives.
Tina, we've got it right there. It sounds like you're for it, and you can imagine all kinds of ways you could help people. You're not the only one. Chris online writes to us, athletes have been doing this for years with training logs, especially now with online training logs. We write down everything from how much we exercise to heart rate to you name it, write them down. We're very OCD about it, he writes, and take pride in our stats, sharing them, bragging about them. It's a way to track progress and make improvements in training. Gary, Eric, we've got lots of response online here. Adam tweets to us, quoting Lord Kelvin, the physicist, if you cannot measure it, you cannot improve it, then you've still got your sort of philosophical skeptics here. Brian says, quotes T.S. Eliot, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? We'll come to it. Matthew in Buffalo, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Matthew.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was calling to get, all of the comments have been great. It's a great show today. And just wanted to weigh in maybe more on the cautionary side of it. I've been an athlete various times, different levels throughout my life, and I agree with what you just said of tracking your stats, and that's how you can improve yourself. But earlier we were talking, your callers and panel were talking about reporting into doctors in real time. And I just immediately started thinking of the movie from the late 90s and Gattaca, and that idea of you are known, your whole life is known instantly at birth, and then judgments are made based on that health information. And immediately started thinking of car insurances now want to track your driving record, and your premiums can be reduced based on that. And so now pre-existing conditions just popped in my mind of health insurance, and now a health insurer will require that I use this tracking device in order to have their insurance. And if I have a bad day and eat that bad food and my cholesterol goes up, that's going to affect my, that real-time spike is going to now affect that judgment of me. And then so just Big Brother is always watching, and I just think it's great to use technology for our benefit and tracking and data, but too much data can be a problem in what it really means. I mean,
yeah, Matthew, we've got it. Let us hold it right there if we may. You don't want to be headed off at the pass from having that extra slice of pizza. We've got it. On the other hand, we've got issues overall. I want to bring it to Eric Topol, if I may, because, Eric, this is right in your wheelhouse. Give us, if you'd be good enough, step back and give, what's the big transformative upside vision on healthcare, how that would work, and what about these downside concerns you're hearing?
Well, just to touch on the downside, there's no question that's already been brought up about this digital dystopia, and it's really essential that it's the individual's data, and that person should own that. And that's the fear of, you know, whether this be used in the wrong way by employers or government and that sort of thing. You know, we have to have this centered on the individual, because that is essential.
Now, but you can easily imagine a norm eventually emerging where even most people are monitored, and if you're not willing to give over your numbers, you won't get insurance, or it'll cost you a lot.
Oh, no, I don't think this is, you know, we can't even have a mandate, you know, for health. There's not going to be any mandate that people have to be monitored. But I think what's going to be the case is that for, you know, people are not going to have a monitoring of every physiologic aspect of their health. They're going to have what's relevant to their condition. You know, they have high blood pressure, or they have diabetes, or they have pre-diabetes, that sort of thing. I see it as a very selective use, because these things are not going to be for free. They require sensors, and you know, there's algorithms to deal with the data that are going to be very important to make these systems practical. And so this is not something that's going to be pervasive for, you know, everybody having all sorts of body monitoring. I don't see that at
so
all.
But what is your upside vision then of how American healthcare might be revolutionized? You're talking creative destruction, big transformation. What would it look like if we use this monitoring to its optimal effect?
Well, the key here is now we are having remote monitoring in a way where we can actually get to the point of preventing illness. So, you know, we have ways now that we have can monitor a heart attack in incubation, you know, days or a couple of weeks before it even happens. And, you know, already Gary is talking about autoimmune type 1 diabetes. That takes 5 years for the pancreas to have destruction. Well, that can be monitored, and you could give a medicine when there's an immune attack on the pancreas to prevent that from ever occurring. So we have new opportunities here we never had before. But, you know, just going back, Tom, to the blood pressure, which is certainly one of the biggest problems we have in healthcare, that is, we know that half the people do not have their blood pressure controlled. They're vulnerable to heart attacks and strokes. Now, all of a sudden, we have the data for each of those individuals, whether it's actually controlled. This is a whole new day. And then to get the right medicine, the right dose for the right patient, you know, we just don't have this in medicine today. It doesn't exist. We've never had access to the data.
But we may soon. Lots of people getting it already. Gary, I'll come to you first. Stark in Fishersville, Virginia. Stark, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. Appreciate you taking my call today. I really want to shoot some holes in your specialist theories. First off, fact that they will come up with ways to tie this to unneeded surveillance. Virginia just passed a law that requires a woman to have a, they wanted transvascular exam, but now they've gone to the belly, jelly on the belly, but and they don't pay for it. So the government will get involved in one way or the other. It's the second point is cost. The people that are overweight, high blood pressure, diabetes, etc., where are they going to get the $500 to buy the iPhone or the BlackBerry? I'm talking to you on a phone that does not have apps.
Yep.
So, and the $60 a month that you have to pay to use those apps.
Sure.
Information is great, but the people you're talking about can't afford it, and I don't think the government's going to kick in and buy these things for us.
Stark, let us pick those two up, cost and privacy. Gary Wolf, let me come first to you on cost. Where do you see this headed over time? People think in terms of what we see now, $500 and $60 a month maybe, you know, for the smartphone and the service. Do you see more mass use of this down the road? Could this get down to, you know, pennies or dollars or widely affordable, universally affordable?
Yes, well, I agree with most of what Eric said, but one place I might disagree is just on that topic. I do think that we're headed towards pervasive and very cheap. And when we get there, and the curve is pretty obvious if you just look at how much the underlying technologies cost, when we get to pervasive and cheap, there will be pressures, just as your last caller said, on people to participate. And perhaps because my background is journalistic, I don't really have a strong need to say that this will be a utopian or a dystopian scenario in the future. I think it is what it is. There will be massive uses of these technologies, and the meaning of them, whether they're used for more dystopian ends or more utopian ends, is to some extent up to us, how intelligent we are, how engaged we are, how active we are in using the technologies and saying what they're good for. Just like with computing, if computers were only in the hands of the 1% and the people they hired to use them, it would be a different world and it would be a worse world. It turned out that computers got into a lot of hands, and that made a world that was better than it might have otherwise been. And I think the same is true of these technologies.
Gary Wolf in California, let me ask you, here's Franco writing to us on Facebook. He says, hey, it's also good for letting Big Brother government toss us out of healthcare or know when we think something unpatriotic. Thought police are coming. He says, not that they necessarily know exactly what we're thinking, but they may see a pattern of psychological responses that indicate rebelliousness. I mean, what about the privacy issue here? Once all this information is collected anywhere, isn't this sort of general trend for it to go an awful lot of places? Eric Topol says it'll belong to the individual. It can't be mandated. But let's say an insurance company or the government. I mean, there's ways to leverage you towards sharing, even if that's not what you first intend, Gary, or even if you don't even know it.
Yes, there are. And we're already seeing companies forming whose business model involves helping corporations engage their employees in tracking themselves so that they'll lower their overall healthcare costs. And those forms of engagement, quote unquote, do sometimes involve financial incentives. So that's just a foot in the door. There's no question that when new technologies emerge that are really powerful, everybody tries to use them for whatever ends they already have, you know, in their own context. So the Big Brother has his hands on these tools and is very, very interested in using them to enforce compliance with social norms and sort of regulatory ideals. That does not mean that we ought to leave them alone as individuals and just pretend that they don't exist. In fact, in the quantified self, there are many highly technical people whose knowledge of how these tools can be misused is one of the things that motivates them to get them into their own hands and ask how they can be well used.
Boy, this is really interesting stuff. Let's go to Marla calling from Underhill, Vermont. Hi, Marla. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So my husband, this is very interesting to me because I'm actually a registered nurse,
okay,
and my husband has an application called logsitall.com that tracks people's health and their fitness levels, blood sugar.
Yeah.
And we talk about this quite regularly, and I think insurance companies are generally going to start covering, you know, the prevention of these apps, these apps for the prevention of health care-related illnesses in the long term, because I think the benefits really are there. And I actually just completed a workplace physical and health prevention where my workplace reimbursed me for doing the actual test to see what my cholesterol was and see what my blood sugar was. And I can see these apps being something beneficial for the long-term tracking of that. And I was just going to say that I really do think the cost is not going to be disclusive of other people. And as far as having a mobile app, it doesn't have to be mobile. It can be on a computer itself. So I really do think that there's a long-term benefit to these.
We can see it from a nurse's point of view. I totally get it. But could you see insurance companies or employers, et cetera, to discriminating on the basis of this data flow, Marla?
I think laws like HIPAA, you know, HIPAA is the Privacy Act, of course, but I think that there's going to be laws that do come in place to prevent that from happening as well, you know, similar to insurance companies not being able to discriminate once you're, you know, enrolled in a program. They can't discriminate based on your health care issues.
Marla, I appreciate your call as a nurse. You're on the front line. You know a lot about it. Eric Topol, how, you know, when? What's the big calendar you see in your mind's eye about when we may see transformation on the basis of this kind of monitoring and data flow?
Well, it's happening already. You know, as a cardiologist, to be able to do a cardiogram on a smartphone is a new thing. It's available whereby...
You mean to someone who's not even with you, someone remote?
Right, right. You can just put your fingers on the on a case, add to the back, you know, back of the phone, and then the cardiogram is transmitted. And that is not, we're not talking about heart rate now. We're talking about actual heart rhythm.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you have someone who has a very common arrhythmia, like atrial fibrillation, and so you see it, and you can say, well, you know, you don't need to go to the emergency room. This is what we're going to do. And you can also, by having a handle on that remotely, prevent a stroke. And so this whole idea that one of the earlier questioners had, callers, about the cost, well, the cost of preventing an emergency room visit, or even more so, preventing
the
a stroke.
Savings of preventing
arrhythmia,
it. Yeah,
will clearly override the need, you know, for that person to have the app and the ad for their phone.
Gary Wolf, Brave New World, we've just got half a minute here. I don't know, look 50 years down the road. What's this create, Gary?
Well, I think what it creates depends on what we do now. And I think it pays off to engage these tools, to find out if they have something to offer you, if you have a problem or a goal. Then you get to participate in the conversation more knowledgeably.
Boy, it's really something. The sun keeps coming up on this digital era in new ways. This one, a lot of people plugging into it already in your world and beyond, Gary. We're grateful to you for being with us today to give us some big insights on it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gary Wolf, writer for Wired Magazine. Look for his forthcoming book, Quantified Self. And joining us today from Berkeley, California, and Eric Topol. His book is The Creative Destruction of Medicine, How the Digital Revolution Will Create Better Healthcare. Forbes called it a must-read. It's all about exactly this. Eric Topol, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, great to have you with us. Thanks for all your thoughts and insights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.